This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. We've known for a while that the Granite State skews older than much of the country, with a median age of about 42. Still, it was a bit of a shocker when we were recently dubbed second oldest in the nation, coming in just a little younger than Maine. Now, many say our state's not ready for this demographic reality, from our transportation systems to our healthcare sector to our state budgets. But at the local level, there are efforts underway, many being chronicled by the union leader in a new year-long series called Silver Linings. Today in The Exchange, how prepared is New Hampshire to age gracefully? What do you think? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests. Joining us from Hanover is Dr. Stephen Bartels. He's a professor at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice and director of the Centers for Health and Aging at Dartmouth. And Dr. Bartels, welcome back. Good to have you.
Great to be here.
Also with us in studio, Gretchen Grosky, health and aging reporter for the Union Leader, who's working on that series I mentioned, Silver Linings, Issues of Aging in New Hampshire. And Gretchen, nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Also with us, Steve Norton, executive director of the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies. He's been looking at these demographic numbers for a long time. Steve, welcome back. Good to see you.
Great to be here, Laura.
So give it to us straight, Steve. How old are we?
Well, there are a couple different ways of thinking about it. One, economists often look at the indicator, the percentage of the population over the age of 65. And the average in New Hampshire in the United States is about 15% of the population. New Hampshire is about 16% of the population.
So not that many people over 65.
That's right. To give you context, Maine is the oldest by that measure, 21% of its population.
Oh, wow. That's a big difference.
However, we have a median age that is either second or third highest in the country, which means that we are old by that measure. But I would argue that at least right now, we're in our economic prime at the age of 43. What we have coming is a different issue, and that's the aging of this boomer population that has loved New Hampshire for so many years. And we're going to age much more quickly than most other states in the country because of that large population of boomers that live here. So right now, are we old? No, we're in our economic prime, but we've got some issues that we're going to have to face going forward.
Yeah, I was looking at the numbers again this morning, and you're right, Steve, to say second or third. It seems like Maine, clearly, number one. Okay, so there you go, Maine. New Hampshire and Vermont seem to bump back and forth.
That's right, and that could be either statistical precision of the estimates or could actually be aging. It's hard to tell the difference.
So all northern New England.
What's going on there? If you look at a map,
it's such a pretty place.
It's such a pretty place, but where a lot of the population growth is occurring is in the southwestern part of the country. A lot of the source of growth in the population is Latino and African American. We have much lower rates of ethnic diversity in the Northeast, and as a result, we're getting older.
All right, we'll dig into it a lot this hour. And Gretchen, you've been digging into it in your series, Silver Linings, and congratulations
on
that. What's the thinking behind the union leader putting, you know, a whole year-long effort on this?
Well, a lot of the credit goes to my executive editor, Trent Spiner, who had been reading up on Mr. Norton's studies and realized that this is a serious issue facing New Hampshire. And for newspapers, it's always a struggle to cover the big issues because we're so busy every day putting out a newspaper, whether it be selectmen's meetings or elections, that he looked for a way to focus just solely on this issue. So working with the New Hampshire Endowment for Health, the endowment funded the position for 1 year. It's a solutions-based journalism position where my job is not just to cover the problems that are associated with an aging population, but to look for solutions and whether those solutions be here in New Hampshire or in New England or in the United States or across the world. I do have a travel budget to go seek out those solutions that may be applicable here in New Hampshire.
When did you get started, Gretchen?
Beginning of August.
Okay, so pretty recently.
Yes.
And you've done a ton of reporting already, and we'll dig into it. But what's jumped out at you the most as you started this big project?
I have to tell you, one of the first people I met with was Steve, and it was eye-opening. You look at your state in a whole different way. I looked at, I have school-age kids. My oldest, actually, he's a sophomore in college. And he was part of a class that was huge, that the schools were dealing with, how are we going to fit all these kids into our school?
Really?
Now I have a third grader, and we're looking at empty classrooms. And it just kind of ticked that, yes, there is a big change going on here, that a lot of the younger families that I knew from my older son have moved out, and there are a few of us left. And just looking around and going around and talking at senior centers, and you just realize there's such a vibrancy among this group of elders. But really, like, looking ahead 10 years and saying, how are they going to get to the senior center?
Because there's no public transportation, and you don't want them driving.
Absolutely. And there's definitely a mindset among the seniors when you go out there is that they don't want to be a burden. And it's kind of sad to think that they would think of themselves as a burden. But there's a lot of resiliency in this generation that's coming up.
So interesting to hear you talk about your own personal experience with your son, who's now probably, 20.
Yeah.
And when he was a kid, the big debate was, our schools are stuffed. What are we going to do? And now with your youngest, it's, gee, there's not enough kids to fill this classroom. I guess we'll squeeze everybody into one classroom instead
Absolutely.
Of two. Well, Dr. Bartels, I want to bring you into this too. What's foremost in your mind as you look at these trends that Steve and Gretchen are describing?
Well, I think foremost in my mind is the issue of the workforce, which is to say that not only do we have an aging population that's going to need help with health care services and support services to so-called age in place, but I think also the workforce itself is aging. So we know in New Hampshire that the nursing, for example, individuals who are nurses, over two-thirds are over the age of 40. And we know that also with individuals aging and having younger people not staying in New Hampshire, we're missing out on that critical workforce that's going to be taking care of people to stay at home. So we're really concerned about that. We're concerned also about whether or not the conventional health care providers are prepared for this so-called silver tsunami. Are primary care providers ready to have a large portion of their practice over time get older and older and be overage 85, which is the fastest growing segment of the population, where lots of things pile up, both physical disabilities, lots of health care problems, and also Alzheimer's disease.
Wow. So conventional providers, you worry, Dr. Bartels, aren't ready for what it's going to take.
Correct. And what we are doing about that are several things. One is we're lucky to have gotten a large grant from the Health Resources Services Administration at Dartmouth called the Geriatric Workforce Enhancement Grant, about $2.5 million, to basically redesign primary care across New Hampshire, helping to put into practice prevention screening, coordinated care for chronic health conditions, advanced care planning, that really important component of being able to express your preferences and have it honored in terms of end-of-life care. And then finally, helping primary care physicians better prepared for taking care of dementia and other forms of cognitive impairment disorders such as Alzheimer's disease.
So your biggest concern is workforce issues, and we'll definitely jump into that, including Dr. Bartels, an issue I'm hearing a lot about, which is workforce silos, different types of healthcare workers who might be able to do certain things to help this population but aren't allowed to by law and so forth. So I wonder if you want to quickly comment on that, because that's a complaint I hear.
Oh, absolutely. We really think that the care needs to be completely redesigned to be team-based care, to have people be functioning at the highest level of their license, and that health outreach workers and people that can be trained at our community colleges to go out into the community and touch the individuals who need to help in their homes and be supported by the primary care team back at the office is really the way we need to go. So rather than building nursing homes, building more long-term care facilities, we should be advancing long-term care to be entirely community-based and team-based.
Our phone number here in the Exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the Exchange, we're picking up on the work of a new union leader series, a year-long series on aging in New Hampshire. It's called Silver Linings, and we're asking the question, how ready is the Granite State for its new demographic reality, the second oldest state in the nation? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.com. nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, you can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. So before we get too down in the dumps, folks, I mean, and Gretchen, you've reported on this, and Steve, you talked about this. What are the benefits that you're hearing, Gretchen, of an older state? I mean, you've done some stories where people say, look, this is not all bad.
Absolutely not. There will be a whole new economy that comes out of it. AARP refers to it as the longevity economy. As people are living longer, they're working longer, and they're looking for ways to contribute. It's going to change the way we buy things. It's going to change the way we things like as we drive less, we'll probably be buying fewer cars.
That doesn't sound good for the economy.
It doesn't sound good for the economy, but, you know, where does that go? How do we reinvent ourselves? And I think there's a whole generation that's out there that's ready to step in.
What is the longevity economy in your mind, Steve?
Well, so first thing, this is happening across the world, the industrialized world. It's happening Japan. In the United States. It's happening in New Hampshire maybe a little bit more quickly. So, I mean, this is a reality. And it's something that we have to manage. And there are some negative consequences from an economic perspective. Economists say that our economy is going to grow less quickly than it has in the past.
Because older people just don't buy stuff as much.
They spend things differently. They spend much more money on healthcare, less on transportation, less on pensions, less on housing. So there is a fundamental shift that has to be recognized. Now, within that fundamental shift, can you build out positive economic activity? Absolutely. And I think that's what people are trying to get to with this question of the longevity of community.
So more hospitals, less Home Depot.
That's correct. And, and you know, the biggest growth industry in the United States are going to be service industries, largely serving the baby boomers over the next, you know, 10 or 15 years. So how do we do that as a state while maintaining some of these other activities which aren't age-based, whether it's, you know, bringing young people to New Hampshire or creating industries that are about the new economy out in the rest of the world?
Well, Steve, a lot of people quoted in Gretchen's series said the same thing over and over. We're not ready. I'm sure you were one of them. How are we not ready?
Well, so as Steve Bartels is probably the best one to talk about on the ground level. Communities have a 2 or 3 or 4 year planning perspective. And when you think about how communities think about their 10 year plans, they're not adjusting quite yet to the reality of how steep an increase we're going to see in an aging population. So that's one thing. State government is not yet prepared for the potential public resource implications of an aging population. The population over age 85, as Dr. Bartels mentioned, is increasingly reliant on sometimes public services, and that will be a financial drain. On the state as well as local communities, particularly the counties. And I think probably the only place where we're starting to get prepared is around this workforce issue. Whether it's the medical community led by Dr. Bartels or the business community looking out on its manufacturing floor and seeing a graying workforce, they're starting to engage a little bit. So much of the state unprepared, some pockets of preparedness occurring.
What do you think, Dr. Bartels? In what ways do you see us as unprepared?
Well, I think that, you know, much of the communities have been built up around younger populations. And so there's a whole movement afoot across the country around so-called age-friendly communities, redesigning settings for older adults to be integrated in a multi-generational environment where they have sidewalks, walkable communities. They have homes that are designed to be more wheelchair accessible and even equipped with technology. And so I think that some of the things that we can do that are really on the positive end, Laura, are the merger between redesigning and thinking about communities differently. Thinking about, I actually don't like the term aging in place. I like the term aging in community, because aging in place often means, you know, come hell or high water, I'm going to stay right where I am, even if I become frail and need assistance, as opposed to knowing that people age best when they're surrounded by social supports and by people that they love and in turn are having meaningful activities and things that contribute to the community. So we really need to reframe the way we think about not only social needs, but also thinking about the whole person as in terms of that social health is equivalent to physical health in many respects for older adults. And designing communities, thinking about, again, equipping both technology and people to help support people to age in community is where we need to go.
Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. newhampshirenews.org. What do you think New Hampshire needs to do, whether as a state or at the community level, to really get ready for our new demographic realities? Second oldest state in the nation. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Len on Facebook asks, what is needed to provide for the aging while retaining our youth? And Gretchen, I think you wrote a piece about how, you know, creating an age-friendly community actually has benefits for everybody.
Absolutely. You think of the simple issue that Dr. Bartels brought up is sidewalks. And if you go into the rural area, I come from a small town. I come from Atkinson. There are no sidewalks.
Yeah.
Who does a sidewalk benefit? It benefits the kids on the bicycles. It benefits the mom with the stroller. It benefits the older person with the walker or the wheelchair. Simple things like putting in lane on roadways. That is a simple, cheap way of making your community a little friendly. You can't build a sidewalk. Well, put in a lane on the roadway, designated as such. And I think that's what it's all about, is this age-friendly community is really not just thinking about the seniors. It's thinking about everybody.
Yeah, and there was a compelling story in that about, you know, you start off asking an older gentleman, what do you want? And he said, outdoor space, sidewalks, you know, walkable, public transportation. And then you talk to some younger people, what do you want? Same thing.
Exact same thing.
So go ahead, Steve. Jump in.
And I just say that there's a part of this conversation that we're not yet ready to have, I think, and that is there is a rural versus an urban component to this, and there are some things that we can do in an urban area that we can't do in rural areas. We cannot probably build out livable community in all 240 towns in New Hampshire, that there's a certain density requirement, there's a certain financial requirement that is going to have to be met. And I think that's one conversation we're completely not prepared to have yet. We continue to think that every person is going to be able to age successfully in their community, and I'm not sure that that's the frame that we're going to be able to take going forward.
Because the resources just aren't there in some of these rural communities.
Exactly right.
Despite what Dr. Bartels says, which we all know, the social supports and so forth are so important, but if someone's way out and there's no one around to help.
That's right. And that's why from a policy perspective, I think one of the things that I learned from Dr. Bartels is that a big part of this is actually educating the older person about how they're going to age so that they can prepare themselves in some way for the frailties and the changes in their homes or even the changes in their location that they have to make.
Mm. Go ahead, Dr. Bartels. I can hear you wanted to jump in.
I was going to add one of the things that we should be thinking forward about, which is the hopeful part, is I think technology is going to have a huge role, particularly in rural settings. So we can not only equip homes with sensors, so-called smart homes, but put on people wristbands that can actually monitor their blood glucose, their blood pressure, their activity, whether or not someone's getting up out of bed, have they fallen. And this is going to literally transform the way we think about health care for older adults. And there's a number of projects around the country and here at Dartmouth-Hitchcock that are specifically engaged in equipping people with those sorts of technologies and 24-hour coaches or monitors that can help intervene when people get into trouble. So especially important in rural settings where, again, access to clinics or healthcare providers are pretty limited, but that doesn't mean that people have to end up in nursing homes.
So is that telemedicine? Is that what you're talking about, Dr. Bartels?
Yeah, well, it's under that whole umbrella of telemedicine. It ranges from having so-called remote sensors, things that are on people's bodies that help us know whether they're doing okay and whether they're up and around and getting in good health, as well as being able to literally come into their homes virtually through a video phone or some other device where we can talk to individuals and check in with them. So this is really where the future of medicine is likely to go for chronic long-term problems, which is to say that we're going to be increasingly linked into people in a positive way to help have them live independently and function at a high level.
All right, a lot more to talk about, including housing, transportation, and just broader community structures, community activities. And we'll take your calls, so stay with us, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. With New Hampshire now the second oldest state in the nation, how ready are we to meet this demographic reality? From healthcare to transportation to community structures, many say we are quite unprepared. What do you think? The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. What does New Hampshire need to do? What does your own town need to do to get ready for this demographic reality? Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our guests are Steve Norton, Executive Director at the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies, Gretchen Grosky, Health and Aging Reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. She's working on a year-long series called Silver Linings. And joining us from Hanover, Dr. Stephen Bartels, Professor at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice and Director of the Centers for Health and Aging at Dartmouth. And all of you, let's go to our listeners now. And Catherine joins us from South Sutton. Hi, Catherine. Thanks for being on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I have a background in the arts and arts education and arts and health, and I just wanted to mention that something we could do in New Hampshire, and there are efforts going on, is to provide a lot of high-quality arts making and community arts activities for seniors. There's been quite a bit of research showing the benefits of this, and actually a North Country Senior Consortium with the Arts Alliance of Northern New Hampshire recently received a grant from the Aroha Center for an Elder Arts, really rigorous, high-quality arts classes. And I think churches, trained teaching artists, the role of libraries in this regard, things like creative writing, but all kinds of ways to create community, but also make and learn.
So people,
I think, is something we can do. It's really something doable, and the New Hampshire State Council on the Arts has some grants, but something to think about and try to build some funding for this.
Well, Catherine, thank you for the call. And Gretchen, I wonder what you're hearing about just broader efforts to have seniors who are engaged and happy, you know, in that social setting that Dr. Bartels talked about.
Well, actually, I was at a conference, the Tri-State Conference Collaborative on Aging held a conference on Friday about caring for the caregiver, which is something, a whole other issue that comes with the an aging population, is that there are a lot more of us caring for an older adult. And I met a woman who's actually started classes for art classes for people who have Alzheimer's and their caregiver. And they find it's a way that they two can work together side by side on a project. But it also gives the caregiver a little bit of respite when they go home. It's a little bit of a hobby just to take your mind off the daily care of somebody with Alzheimer's.
Well, thank you for the call, Catherine. And next to Cornish, Peter's on the line. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. What morning. A great show.
Good. Go ahead, Peter.
I wanted to talk about the issue of transportation. I know you're going to get to it a little more later, but one of the ways we're really not prepared is the issue of an aging population and the place of rail in our central corridor. You know, out here in Cornish, we have what will become a 4-hour train to New York, a 4-hour train to Montreal. Rail traffic for an aging population that doesn't want to drive anymore. The same is true for the east side of the state with the Downeaster. But one of the things that never seems to get calculated in the cost that's always said to be too much of a central corridor train is the fact that our population, 74% of whom say they really want railroads, they don't get included in the calculation made by the legislature. And as a result, the central corridor, 750,000 people, don't have a train, and the train would give them access to the broader New England area.
So, Peter, this is Peter Burling, I'm guessing, the chair of the New Hampshire Rail Authority.
Former chair.
Okay, I stand corrected. Well, let's talk about transportation. And, Peter, thank you so much for calling. And Steve Norton, to you first, but Dr. Bartels, I have a question for you, too.
So a lot of the aging question raises issues around infrastructure, whether it's caregiver infrastructure or the senior service centers or the medical infrastructure or the housing or the support, meals and wheels, and transportation is one of those infrastructures.
Huge,
And it's a complicated question. Peter was talking about rail. What share of the elders who need access to that public transportation can actually get to that rail is probably just as important a question as whether that rail exists. And so, and that's an issue that has proved almost intractable across rural states. it's expensive and difficult to transport a non-dense population to places. So the real question I think that we need to ask ourselves is transportation like telephones, electricity? Do we just subsidize that as a state and as communities because we feel we have some sort of community obligation to do that? We haven't had that conversation yet. We still say that we all want transportation, but no one really wants to pay for the cost of it.
Well, let's talk more about transportation. And, you know, Dr. Bartels, as our earlier caller, Catherine, was talking about, you know, centers for people to come and do something creative and so forth and all the benefits thereof. I was thinking in the back of my mind, that's great if they can get there, but getting there, and I'm guessing you hear this from your elderly patients, can sometimes be a challenge for folks.
Well, all the time, Laura. I mean, I think this issue of transportation is a bidirectional issue, which is to say that on the one hand, we need to think about efficient ways of helping people to get where they need to go. And so, for example, people who have lots of medical problems, you know, why can't we have a system where we have all of their appointments occur in a hospital on one day as opposed to scattered? Why can't we think about Meals on Wheels or so-called home-delivered meals programs actually providing transportation, too? And there are, of course, regulatory concerns about that. But there are some natural opportunities that are out there. At the same time, once again, I think it's important for us to know that many older adults want to receive services or participate in meaningful activities where they live and reside and where they seek other people. And so thinking about bringing services out into the community as much as possible, whether they be cultural ones or health-related ones or social ones, I think is really important.
Well, how likely do you think, Dr. Bartels, this is to change, you know, given the costs that Steve talked about, given that our whole culture, our whole community structure is really set up around cars? I mean, you know, from where the grocery store is to where the healthcare places are. You know, our culture is basically focused on the car.
Well, I think that's true. And what's really interesting is that we're learning from developing countries how to change healthcare here in the United States, where we often think we know all the answers and we don't. So there have been lots of programs that have been developed in, for example, rural India or Africa or China, where in rural settings where, again, transportation doesn't exist and health professionals are few and far between, where people living in the community have been trained to provide many of the support services, healthcare services, and other sorts of things that people normally would get in their car to get to.
I see.
So I think, and this is what we call a reverse innovation. A couple of professors at Tuck School here at Dartmouth have coined that phrase to think about looking into under-resourced countries and then taking those innovations and planting them back into settings, particularly rural ones here in the United States, where we can learn from these other countries how to do things better.
Well, and I remember interviewing that gentleman, actually, who wrote that book, Reverse Innovation. But Dr. Bartels, this gets back to silos. I'm sorry to bring this up again, but, you know, big, important doctors at big, important hospitals may have to give up some of that control or prestige if you're going to create that vision that you talk about.
Well, I think so. And I think it's about rejuvenating the primary care delivery community at all the levels. And that includes not only physicians in primary care offices, but nurses and nursing assistants and direct care service workers who are so important. And then as one of the guests on this show mentioned, you know, the people are who are most providing care are caregivers. And so we need to focus on helping them with their what they need to help people to age in home, including the health care and emotional services and supports that they need so that they can do the important work of taking care of their loved ones.
Go ahead, Gretchen.
Actually, there's some examples of that are currently going on. It's the notion of community nurses and parish nurses. In Canaan, Vermont, the community has gotten some benefactors together to hire a part-time nurse that cares for the town's the town seniors. She'll make house calls. Obviously, she can't do everything as just a nurse, but she is in constant communication with a team of doctors and healthcare providers and social workers. And there's also a parish nurse up in Lyme, where where the church has brought on a nurse to care for its population.
Well, Dr. Bartels, real quick, this came up a couple of years ago. I remember the dental hygienists in the North Country wanted the ability to provide, to operate solo, because they said there just weren't enough dentists in rural areas. And the dentist said they were concerned about quality and problems being missed or overlooked. So there's this sort of turf issue that comes up.
Indeed, there is, and we need to get beyond this, which is to say that on the one hand, yes, we want to have people that have the credentials and the skills to do what they need to do, but we also can't, in the interest of guilds, prevent people from getting what they need. So you don't really need a nursing degree to look at a very red foot on a diabetic person and know that that's not good. Caregivers and families do that all the time.
All right. Well,
so
Peter,
it's absolutely possible that we can train people and certify them at lower levels to do many of these things that otherwise, and then reserve the really complicated things for those specialists that really need to devote that, because there's more than enough healthcare need to go around.
Peter, thanks a lot for the call about transportation, a big issue when we look at this. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Here's the question we're asking on The Exchange. What does New Hampshire need to do to really get ready for our new demographic reality of second oldest state in the nation? Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. On these workforce issues that we've been talking about, a couple emails have come in. Alice in Exeter, she says, Steve mentions having workforce members that can practice to the full extent of their education. Does he believe that nurse practitioners can perform fully as primary care providers? What does the data show about comparative rates of new physician grads in comparison to nurse practitioner grads? Alice says, I'm a nurse in a master's degree program. She says, that's probably obvious. In some states, nurses are actually allowed to be the PCP. What about New Hampshire? Dr. Bartels, real quick.
Well, we work with nurses all the time, and nurse practitioners are terrific. The co-director of my aging center happens to be a geriatric nurse practitioner and does fabulous home visit work as well as helping to lead my center. So I think that these are absolutely the right questions that we should be thinking about. An interdisciplinary team of different types of professionals all working at the top of their license.
Well, Alice, thank you for the email, and good luck to you as you pursue your degree. Obviously, New Hampshire needs you. Here's one from Samantha. As a stay-at-home mother of young children who would love the opportunity to finish a degree in nursing specifically to work with our aging population, Samantha says, I think the nursing programs in our state need to reevaluate their ability to meet the needs of students. Many students are not fresh out of high school with no responsibilities, and the lack of evening and or weekend programs for the nursing field really limits the ability of highly capable students to further their pursuits in the healthcare industry. As Samantha says, my childcare options are limited. Steve, again, here we've got these workforce needs. People like Alice and Samantha who want to be part of this workforce, but they're facing roadblocks.
I think whether we're talking about medical care, healthcare, nurses, doctors, or manufacturing workers, everyone now is scrambling to try and figure out how to accelerate the capacity to bring workers to these various different industries. And I know, for example, that the community college system is very focused on healthcare and how they're going to support the next generation of practitioners, just as they're focusing on HVAC workers and others. So. But we're just at the leading edge of this. We're just beginning to realize that we're having profound nursing shortages, what people are calling the caregiver crunch, and they're just getting up to speed.
Okay, so caregiver crunch, and yet, Steve, for the past 5, 6, 7, 8 years, most of the emphasis, conversation, money, in terms of grants or whatever, has been focused on STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, to the detriment, some people are now starting to say, for these caregiving workforces.
Yeah, unfortunately, sometimes what happens with policy is we oversteer. We all said that manufacturing was going to die, and now we can't find any plumbers or folks that can fix, air conditioners. So there's always the danger that when you put all your resources into one bucket, you miss out on the broader needs of the community.
The other conversation that I hear, Stephen, you and I have talked about this before, is, people saying we need to, quote unquote, bring young people in to fill these jobs. What about making better use of the people who are already here, young and middle-aged? I remember when he ran in the gubernatorial primary on the Republican side, Representative Frank Edelblue said several times, let's stop moaning and groaning about this aging workforce. Let's look at the opportunities, the skills, the experience of middle-aged and older people and make something of this, of what we've got.
Right. I think we're not going to solve the workforce problem in any one way. We're going to find a way to get millennials to come here, and that's going to depend on what's happening in New Hampshire relative to Massachusetts and other places. We can take advantage of retraining of the 40 to 60-year-old person who is ready for the next career, and we can educate our own better. Our high schoolers now are going to be the workers in 10 years. Let's make sure that we're hitting each of these bucket so that we can get to the next generation of workforce, which is going to be the millennials.
All right. Well, thanks again for those two emails, Samantha and Alice. And let's go back to our listeners. Justin is in Meredith. Hi, Justin. You're on the line. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Thank you so much to you and your guests for discussing this topic today. And largely, I'm calling to say thank you. I chair the Economic Development and Sustainability Committee in Meredith, New Hampshire. Meredith's a very fortunate community because of our position on Lake Winnipesaukee. But a few years ago, we realized we are the second oldest town in Belknap County. Belknap County is the second oldest county in New Hampshire. And
wow.
As you mentioned, New Hampshire, yeah, we are ground zero.
There you go.
Yeah. And so the town got together and we said, you know, we're going to address this head on. And we've been doing it for about a year now. And the more you get into it, the more you realize, good Lord, this is not an easy problem. You know, do we spend our resources making our schools better to attract young families? Or do we spend our resources providing services that seniors need? Do we try and attract millennials? Or do we try and help middle-aged folks retrain for jobs? The more we've gotten into it, the more we've realized, good Lord, this is really a big challenge,
wow,
not just for us, but for statewide. So I just thank you guys for being on the radio and doing everything you can to discuss it and start trying to figure out how as a state and as individual towns we answer it.
Well, so real quick, and then I can see Steve Norton wants to jump in. But Justin, so where do you put your resources? I mean, you're right, they're limited. So what do you think?
I don't have the answer.
Not yet, anyway.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, we've had a lot of long and hearty debate on this topic, and there's no easy solution. And I think the best thing we can do is having you folks and folks like you talk about it and going, you know, listen, there's no panacea that's going to solve all the problems.
All
here,
right. So. Well, Justin, when you figure it out, give us a call. I'm sure a lot of people would want to hear what you've learned from that. Steve Norton, go ahead. Very well said.
Yeah, very well said, Justin. And the legislature is actually beginning to grasp this. Representative Neil Kirk, who's chair of the Finance Committee, with the help of a businessman named Eric Herr, put together a report that begins to address these questions. That report looked at data from the demographic changes, projections off into the future, convened a group of people to have conversations to identify maybe some goals that we could have. And they include some of the things that Justin just mentioned, better schools to ensure that we get young families, migration goals as a state that we might want to think about, ensuring that demographic change is infused in every policy decision, including one around the financing of the state budget. And that report came out, and I think it will serve as a platform for this next legislature to at least begin to include all of this, these important questions. How do you make a rational decision between investing in this area or this area?
Wow. So the legislature is interested in this, and maybe we'll talk about this after the break, Steve, partly because it cares about the state, obviously, but also because there are huge state financial repercussions of this, the Medicaid budget and so forth. So we'll talk about that in just a minute. Justin, thank you so much for your call. You can join us, too, at 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, with New Hampshire now the second oldest state in the nation, how ready are we? Whether it's healthcare, transportation, the way our communities are set up. Let's hear from you. What do you think? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And Gretchen Grosky with the Union Leader is with us, Steve Norton with the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies, and Dr. Stephen Bartels, Director of the Centers for Health and Aging at Dartmouth. All of you, right back to our listeners. Lots of questions coming in. And here's one from Andy, who says, the sustainability of this demographic change will be determined in no small part by New Hampshire's move to Medicaid-managed care. Andy says, it's funny nobody's talking about this. It's the largest contract in state history. It has an enormous impact on anyone who pays taxes and on anyone who uses, intends to use, or has an elderly family member who might use health care. Not to mention the definitive impact it will have on the population's health as the state ages. Andy says this is the sort of stuff that's boring until it turns into bad policy that affects everyone. Andy, thank you so much. Steve, I want to throw that to you, but first to you, Dr. Bartels. I think people often think that Medicare covers it all, that Medicaid is just for low-income folks and doesn't really affect this elderly demographic. So set us straight on that.
So Medicare, as you know, covers primarily everybody who is over the age of 65 as an entitlement, and also some people with disabilities. And then Medicaid also is configured to take care of people who are either low income or have disabilities. And so there's kind of this overlap that's in place, but nonetheless, it doesn't adequately cover the terrain of what's needed. And certainly for people in New Hampshire, in the Medicaid system, those individuals who are older, who spend down their assets, end up in nursing homes often, and Medicaid is the primary payer for that and creates a huge financial challenge for the state of New Hampshire.
Yeah, and Steve, you're the former state Medicaid director, so near and dear to your heart. Go ahead.
Yep. So we've done some simulations of what happens to the state budget when you age as we're anticipated to age and you provide services the way we currently provide services. And what you learn fairly quickly is that it's basically unsustainable, that we'll shift from financing largely care for, you know, those under 45 to largely those over 85, and that's going to create quite a bit of conflict. This is made more complicated by the fact that the long-term care systems within the Medicaid program that Steve, Dr. Partels was talking about are funded largely by the county. And so there's a real fight brewing, I think, about the responsibility for program and the financing of the long-term care system going forward.
Wow, right, because nursing homes are run by counties, and so that's where that comes in.
And so let's just imagine what the caller before Andy was talking about was the state had anticipated moving all of its populations into some form of managed care. Right now they've only done acute medical care and some behavioral health services. Will we as a state move our long-term care services within the Medicaid program into managed care? That is a question that is, from a policy perspective, not yet answered.
Okay. Well, again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Andy, thank you for that email. Here's another email that came in about community structures and housing. This person asks, why are we building senior communities like Quail Hollow and Lebanon that would attract seniors when we want multi-age? Don't they attract seniors from out of state? Gretchen, as you were doing your reporting, did you hear people say, look, if we focus too much on making ourselves, you know, comfortable and friendly for elders, we will bring in too many old people?
Absolutely. But I've heard the converse, too, that the boomers that are living in homes now and moving to these active communities or independent living, they had the kind of living, affordable houses, one floor, ranches, capes, things like that, that those are actually the price point right now for millennials, and that there is an increase in the number of younger families moving into places like Hillsborough County and Rockingham County, and people hoping that that spreads northward.
Yeah, Steve, I know you guys did a whole report a couple years ago on how, you know, our housing structure here in New Hampshire is like a pair of pants that used to fit and it doesn't fit anymore.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, go ahead.
We're just seeing now the front edge of what the baby boomers are going to do. Are they going to move to the cities and buy small little condominiums that have access to healthcare services and grocery stores and the like? And I think over the next 5 years, we're going to have to change our housing strategy to reflect those patterns.
Yeah, and just remind us, you've talked about how sometimes local zoning ordinances work to the benefit of that change, and other times local zoning ordinances say, no, you need X acres and you need, you know,
that's
all
right.
This other stuff.
That's right. One of the things that I thought was a really positive sign in terms of the state thinking ahead was the passage of a law last year allowing accessory use in houses, so that creates in-law apartments and opportunities for more housing that is affordable and good for both the younger populations and the older populations.
And real quick to you, Dr. Bartels, what about this housing issue? I don't want you to comment specifically on this one senior community that our emailer talks about, but there has been a lot of hue and cry in recent years over, you know, are we building too much senior housing? And I wonder what you think. I know that's a little bit outside of your area of healthcare, but I'm guessing that, you know, housing works into some of the healthcare challenges of the people that you work with.
It certainly does. And I think the real issue is having things designed so that people who develop physical challenges can navigate those settings. So having age-friendly houses, having, again, wheelchair accessibility, ramps, bars that can help people get off of the toilet seat or get into the showers, these are all things that increasingly those of us who are aging are looking into. And so many of those one-story ranches that formerly didn't look as attractive maybe years ago compared to the Victorians are looking pretty interesting now to many people as they look forward to wanting to not be in houses that are predominated by stairs and having sidewalks and having all these things that we described. So there's these independent living settings that are, again, configured for older adults. And then there's the communities where people can have access to other individuals and healthcare providers, so-called continuing care communities that allow people to move across the dimension, which have become quite popular and important.
Let's take another call. This is Doug in Manchester. Hi, Doug. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hello. I had a couple of points. First, I wanted to take umbrage with one of your panelists. He made the comment in passing that elderly people wind up spending down their assets, and I'd like to point out you can't spend an asset. You can only spend cash.
Okay.
And if a person has a house worth $1 million, it's not worth a dime unless he sells it, and then he has to live in the street.
Right.
Now, the other point I wanted to make is out of curiosity, I looked up the other day and found out the average Social Security check is less than $900 a month. If you figure that out on 40-hour weeks, it works out to less than $6 an hour.
Wow.
And so the point being that the people in this state who are elderly and living on Social Security can't pay their taxes with their income and so their housing taxes, and so they're in danger of losing their houses. And I think this is happening a lot. Why people should have to pay 30, 40, 50 or more percent of their gross income in taxes strikes me as obscene, and I'll listen off the air.
Well, Doug, thank you so much for calling. And, you know, Steve Norton, we talked earlier about the economic impact in terms of, you know, less Home Depot as people aren't buying new houses and more hospitals. But what about the individual financial impact?
We're looking at this a little bit now in the data. I think everyone believes that there's a certain group that have enough resources and have saved enough that they can purchase their way into whatever community they want to, whether they want to buy a condominium in a city or whether they want to join elder housing in some other way, independent living or active communities. There's also a sense to which lower income individuals are protected by the state's Medicaid program and some. But so what I think this gentleman's pointing out is that there's a whole group in the middle, and we don't know how big it is or what their economic circumstances are, that are living on Social Security, maybe a small pension or something. They have a home. They're unprotected. What are we and what are our obligations as a community or as a state to help those individuals? I think that's a question that we're just beginning to grapple with.
Yeah, and Gretchen, I have seen a lot of senior citizens in more recent years, you know, working at McDonald's, working at grocery stores. You know, I remember when I was growing up, you didn't see older people in those types of jobs. But I think from what I've read, probably from some of your reporting, that we're going to see more of that.
I met a wonderful couple up in Unity, New Hampshire, that had this absolutely beautiful small home on a mountainside where you could see New York, you could see Vermont. And when the town was reassessed, they came in and said, wow, you have a beautiful view. And their home value shot up over $125,000 in
one year.
Wow,
gee, that's a lot.
They took in about $1,600 in Social Security and were putting away $1,100 of that every month to pay for their property taxes. And they were lovely people, both of them. The husband was working as a handyman just to try and make some money. They would collect cans from the neighbors just to buy a case of beer. That was their one luxury, a case of beer that they buy in Vermont. And she was house cleaning, and she's had three strokes. And ended up, thankfully, they were able to sell their home. Their family was not nearby, but they were able to sell their home and move into a smaller thing. But they said, you know, at 80 years old, who wants to move?
Sure. So that gets to what our caller is talking about. Mm-hmm. Let's not forget those older people and soon to be older people,
right,
who are going to struggle to meet some of these financial challenges.
Mm-hmm.
That's an amazing story. Go ahead, Steve.
And this is going to raise the sort of an unknown policy conversation around property tax exemptions for those over the age of 65. And it's, you know, one of those wonky policies, but the state requires that communities provide property tax exemptions to those over certain age and under a certain income. And as we age, there are going to be increasing numbers of individuals that are seeking out those property tax exemptions, but also I think there's going to be increasing pressure to increase them in communities where you've seen large increases in amenities and therefore big increases in the assessed value of various properties. So a hidden public policy conversation that's coming.
Well, and that'll affect local tax bases. If there are more seniors and more of them are needing and asking for these senior tax exemptions, that'll have a stress on the other taxpayers in that pool.
That's correct. The distributional shift of property
taxes. That's not a fun conversation to have if you're a local selectman.
That's not.
All right. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And to Dover, where Peter's on the line. Hi, Peter. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Hi. Yeah, I was at a county meeting last week where Nick Tempus, who used to be the head of DHHS, was talking about how his group, who's working with the county, is working on 1115 waiver for Medicare. And that essentially, it's a federal refunded program to basically redesign the way that Medicare services are provided throughout the state. And the state's divided up into seven different regions. And in Stratford and Rockingham County, parts of Rockingham, the county is taking the lead on that. In other parts, some of the major health care providers are taking the lead on it.
What's the premise, Peter? What's wrong with the way that Medicare delivers services now?
It's really inefficient. It's based entirely on fee-for-service rather than outcomes. So you end up paying a lot of money for something that might not work, and there's not a good way to really track whether the dollars are being used effectively.
Wow.
So so this program is going to set into place a lot of sort of data assessments to figure out what the best way to do things are. It's going to involve looking at who is available for providing services and how we can increase the service provider pool through training and.
Wow, Peter, I'm going to jump in on you just in the interest of time, and I do apologize, but Dr. Bartels, we could probably do a whole hour on that, but it's real interesting. Thank you, Peter.
And what Peter's referring to actually is actually a Medicaid, not Medicare reform. And it's called the 1115 waiver, the Delivery System Reform Incentive Payment Act. And about $150 million are going to be coming to New Hampshire in the next 5 years of federal supports to basically transform Medicaid around three areas: improving care transitions, promoting integrated physical and behavioral health, and then building in a mental health and substance abuse capacity. And it's, as he mentioned, seven regions are doing this. They're putting together what are called integrated delivery networks that will be bringing together community-based social services, hospitals, county facilities, physical health providers, behavioral health providers, all working towards unifying what is a very fragmented system that doesn't work very well. And in about 3 years, about half of Medicaid is likely to be under this a new payment system where, again, we'll be paying for value as opposed to volume. It'll be not in a fee-for-service a bucket anymore.
Well, and
half of that Medicaid.
Speaking of Medicare, and again, this is the federal health care system for Americans over 65. I did want to just quickly ask you, Dr. Bartels, since our caller called worrying about the financial struggles of older Granite Staters, correct me if I'm wrong, once you turn 65, you get Medicare coverage, you've paid into it already. But that doesn't mean you're good to go, right? You never spend another dime on health care. I mean, there are some surprises around this coverage, right, Dr. Bartels?
Oh, absolutely. There's co-payments. There's, depending on what sort of additional supplemental insurance that you've purchased, there are caps. And so it really isn't the case that it's unfettered. And increasingly, though, we're thinking about ways to reshape Medicare, which is also unsustainable nationally in terms of its increase. So you've heard, I'm sure, about accountable care organizations, these organizations, healthcare settings that are taking responsibility for a whole population for a certain amount of money per month and then providing soup to nuts health care. And that's the future of where we're going to be going, because at the current increase in costs, again, it's unsustainable financially for us as Americans.
Well, and Dr. Bartels, real quick, last question for you, please. If you had to focus your efforts on just one piece of this puzzle or one of the buckets that Steve talked about earlier, which one would it be?
again, I think would be focusing on redesigning how we deliver, again, as somebody who's interested in healthcare.
Sure.
That's my frame, which is making a workable system that works and that we can finance. And that includes both behavioral health and substance abuse and physical health and social health, all under one unified team-based approach that's local, that's supported primarily by the so-called health home or primary care delivery system, providing as much as possible community-based integrated care, again, with training a new type of worker assisted by technology to help people to age in community.
How about you, Gretchen? What are you going to be looking at in your next story or two?
Mostly right now, I'm finally, I think I've got a grip on the issues that are facing us, and that's been the biggest, that's been the easiest challenge of this one-year grant. The next part is to look for solutions and looking at how New Hampshire as communities are coming together to really look at this issue and how they are fixing it.
And you'll be looking at communities around New Hampshire and around the region.
Yes.
Who figured this out. Steve, what's coming up in terms of policy debates in the next New Hampshire legislature that focus on this demographic?
Yeah, the biggest one is going to be the state budget. We have, for the first time in many years, likely a surplus that people are going to be interested in spending. And in the context of this primary demographic change, should we be spending money differently or more on the aging population?
Kind of like our caller Justin from Meredith, but on the macro level. Which bucket do you focus on?
That's right.
All right. Well, all of you, I think we'll be talking again. Gretchen, it was nice to meet you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Gretchen Groski, health and aging reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader. Dr. Bartels, good to have you. Thank you for your time.
Great to be here, Laura. Thank you.
Dr. Stephen Bartels. He is director of the Centers for Health and Aging at Dartmouth. And Steve Norton, good to see you. I think we'll see you next week talking about the economy.
That's right. Thanks, Laura.
All right. Steve Norton, executive director of the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.